News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on KMJ. You hear us at 1 o'clock on News Talk 580 and now also at 5 p.m. on FM 105.9. So if you miss it at 1 o'clock, you can hear it at 5 on FM 105.9 KMJ. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea is pretty simple. We just want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to also preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way learn a thing or two about what it means to love your country. That's what each and every guest does, and I call the show Hometown Heroes because of the theory that no matter where your hometown might be in this great country of ours, there are some men and women around you who have done an awful lot to secure that freedom that we enjoy every day. We're going to meet one of those men today, 85-year-old Connell York of Fresno, California. You might know him because he may have tuned your piano once upon a time. In fact, that's the first time I met this gentleman many years ago. You were tuning my mother-in-law's piano.
Yeah, I remember.
And you didn't want to talk to me yet just back then, but now you're ready to tell some of your stories, right?
I'm ready to tell all.
I like the sound of that. Well, let's go back a few years. In fact, we just marked the 70th anniversary of the attacks on Pearl Harbor. I like to ask each and every guest about December 7th, 1941. You would have been about 15 years old. Where were you, and what do you remember?
I was in Phoenix, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And my mother said to me, said, son, well, you'll never have to go to the Army. You're too young.
Mm-hmm.
But I still ended up 3.5 years in the Army.
You did, but at that time, what your mother said that, but what did it mean to you? Was that a shock to your system? Did it register with you that the world was changing?
To me, I was ready to go, so they drafted me in right here in Fresno.
Because you had moved. You were in Phoenix on Pearl Harbor Day, but by 1944, you're here in Fresno?
Moved to Fresno, yeah.
And you turned 18, and they said, we want you?
Yep. And I turned 18 in July,
mm-hmm.
The 18th. August the 15th would be a day that I was inducted.
Mm-hmm. Well, August 15th would be a special day later on for other reasons. But when you went in August of 1944, what were your expectations? What did you think the Army would do with you?
Didn't know for sure, but I sure going to give it a try.
And had parachutes ever run through your mind at all? Did you ever think, you know, it'd be great to jump out of a perfectly good airplane?
No, not at the time.
How did that come about?
When we were drafted and sent to basic training, Camp Roberts, they asked us what three things did we do best?
Mm-hmm.
And I named flying. I wrote music.
Mm-hmm.
And then chemistry.
All right.
Later on. 15 months later, I was in a band,
mm-hmm.
there in Camp Roberts.
Now, you said flying. Had you flown a plane?
No.
This is something you wanted to do.
Well, I'd flown, but I'd ever flown. I've got my private license now, but mm-hmm. they're inactive.
So, you gave the Army this this list of the things that you thought you might want to do.
Mm-hmm.
What did they do with you? How did you end up in an airborne unit?
Well, I volunteered again.
You're not supposed to volunteer in the Army, are you?
They're always looking for volunteers.
They're always looking for them,
looking
sure.
Looking for suckers. Well, anyhow, that came along because the cadet program was over. They knew the war was won, so they weren't training anymore.
Mm.
So, therefore, that eliminated flying part of it. So I decided, parachutes will be pretty close to planes, so I'll just volunteer with the paratroopers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did.
And this was 1944, only a few months before that. The D-Day invasion has occurred in Europe, and, you know, all these paratroopers have gone behind enemy lines, plenty of casualties. Did you know that was, in theory, a dangerous job you were signing up for?
Well, yeah, I did. But danger didn't bother me.
You were ready for it.
Yeah. I had more energy than sense at that time.
More energy than sense. I think I've been guilty of that at times in my life. I think we all have. So what was it like the first time that you got to jump out of an airplane with that parachute on your
back. The first time is the best jump I ever made.
Yeah?
I didn't know what to expect, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But from then on, I was a little scared.
And where was that?
Well, at basic training, we had to jump seven jumps. Six day jumps and one night jump to qualify for our wings in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Uh-huh. Where paratroopers are still learning how to jump out of airplanes.
Yeah.
Just the way they did when you were in there.
Pretty much so, I imagine.
Were you nervous at all first time you jumped?
Mm-mm.
No?
I really wasn't.
Now, when you see today, and maybe the most famous, President George H.W. Bush jumped out of an airplane
mm-hmm.
just a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
You see somebody that age doing it, does it make you want to go up there and try
no,
it again?
No, you couldn't tie me and throw me out. No, sir.
Well, of course, no. You know, all the pilots I've interviewed would say, why would you want to jump out of a perfectly good airplane anyway?
Yeah.
Right? I'm sure with all the jumps you made, they weren't all the same. You said your best one was your first one.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it were, you know, in training or what have you, did you ever have a jump that went haywire a little bit?
Yeah. My night jump, my qualifying jump.
Uh-huh.
It was at night.
So you'd done all the daytime jumps, but you'd never done one at night before?
No. I've only jumped once at night.
Uh-huh.
But we had to qualify for wings, and that was on a Friday night.
All right.
Okay. My name started with Y. I was always the last one out. That kind of bothered me because the plane had dropped a lot of altitude by then.
Oh, less room to jump.
Yeah, so you're supposed to jump about 1,200 feet. And I know that some of those I jumped lower. Well, anyhow, this particular night wasn't too dark, but you couldn't see either. So I looked down, and it looked like trees to me, but it was, I found out it was a little short grass, about that long, about 6 inches. Well, there I was getting all ready to land in trees and landed.
Ooh.
On my feet, stood up, and because I didn't expect to be landing at that time. I expected to land in those trees.
So you thought you were 20, 30 feet off the ground when
yep.
your feet hit the ground.
Boy, was I surprised.
Didn't break anything?
Not a bone. Not a bone.
Were you sore for a while?
Mm-mm.
You were just fine, huh?
Just fine, yeah. I was pretty good shape. But sometimes you get in trouble. If they see you do it, they'll kick you out.
See you do what?
Make a jump and stand up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you got to go into your fall.
Right.
So, but anyhow, that was the most unusual jump I ever made.
But they didn't see you because it was too dark for you to see, much less them.
Uh-huh. I was the only one who knew about it.
Until now we all know about it.
The trees didn't know about it either, just the grass.
For those of us who have never jumped out of an airplane, certainly not in a military capacity, what's the trick? What were some of the methods, the details of successfully jumping and making sure you didn't ruin it?
The main thing is we snapped a static line, they call it, on a line. And the main thing is to make sure that latch is latched. The next thing is that you jump out right. You don't jump tumble out or nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
And things are pretty well taken care of. You're going about 70 miles an hour when it opens.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty good jolt. We had a reserve on our back. And if you didn't hold your head down like this, you'd hit that thing, knock you out.
Mm.
A lot of guys come down colder than a cucumber. Yeah, they leaned against it, and it hit them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that's one thing you had to do to be sure, duck your head, and so you won't get hit. And, of course, land the proper way.
And what's the proper way?
Well, you go into what they call a fall. You hit your feet, and immediately you start into a roll to try to take that weight off your feet,
mm-hmm.
and that's about as good as you can do.
Did your chute always open perfectly every time?
Every time. Right on time. Yep.
I'm sure you saw other circumstances where maybe it didn't open up right for someone
else.
I saw
two that was what they call streamers.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't open. And we never saw any, this was at a distance, and I never saw him hit or nothing. But if they'd pulled their reserve chute, then they might have made it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see any reserve chute at all. Mm-hmm. And I never heard any more about them.
So when you see something like that, does that enter your mind the next time you jump, that fear?
No. No, it didn't bother me. I was aware of it, but there was something happened. And, of course, every jump you make, you hope that your parachute opens right. Mine always did, right on time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the reasons you're sitting here talking with me today, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So you go through this training, you survive that night jump with the ground a little closer than you thought, and now you are officially a paratrooper.
Yes, yep.
Was that a source of pride for you? Did that give you a sense of accomplishment?
Oh, yeah. That entitled you to wear those nice boots,
mm-hmm.
tuck them in, and wear your parachute badge,
uh-huh.
And your company on your shoulders. Yeah, you're a full-fledged parachuter.
And this was with the 11th Airborne?
No, this was in training.
Uh-huh.
Now, 4 days after I got my parachute qualifications, mm-hmm. They sent us overseas. They needed us bad. And they sent us to the Philippine Islands, and that with 11th Airborne Division.
So when you went overseas, were you going with guys that you had trained with or guys you'd never met before?
Both.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I knew some of them, but heck, there's only three that went, that made it, qualified.
Out of how many?
Out of maybe 24, 25.
So you were one of only three that got to go.
Yeah, and then occasionally back there, I don't care if you had a cold, they were looking things to disqualify you. You mm-hmm. had to be perfect health. So that's a compliment to me. Because I knew it was good health, being raised on a farm. I knew how to work and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in good shape. And, boy, it proved it, too, after you got in there.
So you're heading overseas. Had you ever been out of the country before?
No, I hadn't.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, not a ship like that. There were 10,000 men on this old boat.
That's not a ship. That's a city.
Yeah. Boy, I tell you, it gets rough. It gets rough sometimes out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wake up the next morning, that old ocean's just as smooth as glass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine a trip like that, at that age, here you are still 18 years old, not quite 19 yet,
mm-hmm.
around a bunch of guys same age, don't know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of things that enter your mind when you're on a trip like that.
Yeah. I didn't worry about it. I'm not a worrier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a thinker. And none of it ever bothered me because what we was going to do, we'd do.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, it didn't bother me at all.
Was it hard to know that you had family back home?
Yeah. That's one of the rougher part of it. I married my childhood sweetheart.
You talk about your childhood sweetheart. So were you two together even then?
We were married.
You were married when you went over?
Yeah. Asked her to marry me before we went over.
18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want to wait.
No, because she's beautiful. And I knew some old boy would get her. Yeah.
Smart man.
Yeah.
So you're 18 years old. Mm-hmm. You're heading overseas. You've got a wife now to think about that you got to make it home for.
Mm-hmm.
Were you at all nervous or scared or concerned that something bad might happen?
No. I really wasn't. I never have been scared or worried about it because I figured that as healthy as I was going to make it if anybody did.
Mm-hmm.
And being from the farm, you learn how to dodge behind rocks to get squirrels and quails, things like that. So I had all of that down pretty good. So, no, I didn't worry me at all.
All right. Fair enough.
And well, I was lucky, just plain old lucky, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Somebody was looking out for you, huh?
Yep, sure was.
Well, we're going to need to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about what was waiting for Connell York when he got overseas with the 11th Airborne during World War II, the historic parts of that war that he witnessed firsthand, the marks that he still carries with him today from some of his post-war duty, and what he's been up to since World War II. A lot to cover. Hometown Heroes is coming right back here on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9 KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, 85-year-old Connell York of Fresno, California. For more than six decades, he's been tuning pianos, but before he ever did that, he was in the Army in World War II, ended up in the 11th Airborne, and was sent overseas. That's where we left off, but I want to backtrack a little bit. Because I mentioned piano tuner, and music has been a part of your life for a long, long time. In fact, before you ever went overseas, you were doing some other things in the Army in terms of playing an instrument, and that was the cornet primarily?
Mm-hmm.
How'd you gravitate toward that one?
I played a baritone horn, which is a three-valve instrument.
That's what I played in high school.
A baritone?
You betcha.
Really? I'm still playing that. See, I didn't play any three-valve instrument.
Uh-huh.
I don't care if it's a trumpet, cornet, baritone, tuba, sousaphone.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened that they wanted a cornet player. I fed it in and passed the test. They gave us a little test if we could play it or not. Now, that was quite an incident itself.
The test?
That's quite a story itself, how I got into the band.
This was at Camp Roberts,
yeah,
down
Camp
near Paso
Robles?
Uh-huh. Tell me the story. Our listeners want to hear, I'm sure.
We were supposed to have 17 weeks of basic training.
Mm-hmm.
At the infantry camp. And but the 15th week, there was a corporal came out and said, York, you report at a certain place on the double. That means you get on up there.
You betcha.
So here I went. Got up there. There wasn't a soul around, just as blank as it could be. Well, I sat there all day. No lunch, but I sat there, like they said, till I heard the US group bugle calls, basic training there.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot them, and I've played them many times. But then I went home, went to the barracks, my own barracks. So the next morning, I went to the office there and told them about it, and I said, I think I'd better go back out there and wait. They said, well, I think you better too. So here I went. Well, about 9 o'clock, there was a second lieutenant showed up. He asked me if I was York. I said, yes, sir. Well, come on in here, he said. He set his music rack down and handed me a cornet.
Mm-hmm.
He said, now play that. Well, it was Star and Stripes Forever, one of my favorites.
Oh, of course.
I got about halfway through. He folded up his book and said, okay, that's enough. You report here in the morning. So that was the beginning. That's the second day.
Uh-huh.
Now, I was there 4 days, and they shipped me to Fort Benning, Georgia. But I was a musician then, and so they accepted me down there as a musician.
All right.
Yeah, and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, from my basic parachute training, they would let me go and practice with the band.
Mm-hmm. So you were jumping out of airplanes and playing instruments, just not at the same time.
Yeah, I was a paratrooper. I was a musician in a paratrooper outfit.
I wonder how many of those there were out there.
I don't think there was many. I tell you, it was an oddball to me how in the world I ended up like that.
And I'll tell you, there are not too many people who can really nail Stars and Stripes Forever on a brass instrument like that with those quick beats. I know I couldn't. I can't even hum it with those fast notes that Sousa wrote.
You can practice a while, get it.
So, well, let's go back to you heading overseas. You're on this ship with 10,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you played your instrument a little bit aboard ship?
No.
Weren't allowed to?
Well, we didn't have the instrument.
It wasn't there?
Yeah. See, they keep the instruments in the in a room.
In a hold somewhere on the ship.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So we had no instruments along with us.
What did you do to pass the time? Because I'm imagining that's a long journey.
Yeah. I don't smoke or drink, so I didn't bother with that. Well, a lot of the time was just talking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't gamble. Oh, everybody's gambling. Oh. But anyhow, I would just meet up with friends, and we'd talk and learn things, and that's what it was. Yeah, I did a lot of talking.
Did you get any letters from your bride?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she wrote me every day.
Every day?
Every day, and I wrote her.
What did that do for you if you got a letter from her?
Oh, that cheered me up. You look forward to it. Now, being in the band, I was in the headquarters company. They kept us busy. We didn't play the horn all the time, just certain hours. And they would have us do other jobs.
Right.
Now, I'll bet you, I'm going to tell you something that I bet you 98% of the soldiers don't know it.
What's that?
But every letter that was mailed, it was opened and read.
Of course, yeah.
Well, I'd spend 3 and 4 days at that.
You were censoring mail?
Mail, censoring.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because our government was so afraid that somebody would write in a letter and then it'd spread, and they didn't want that. And what initiated this comes from the question you asked me a while ago. There were several of them Dear John letters. We have a way of sealing it back, and nobody knows we have even been there. But every letter was censored. Every day.
Did you ever have to take out a little razor blade and cut out a word here or there?
No. I left it like it is.
Yeah.
If could be left at. Now, there's one or two that had a bunch of information in it. We just destroyed it.
Yeah.
Never did get it.
Hmm.
Yep. Nothing was said about it. That's why we were there. Oh, there'd be 4 and 5 guys in there working at it.
And where did that long journey across the ocean end, and what'd you find when you got there?
Oh, it ended at in the Manila Bay and the Philippine Islands, and it took 21. We were on that boat 21 days.
Woo!
It's a long time. Ships would go zigzag like this, too.
Right.
And you could look
to dodge around the submarines.
Yeah, and you'd look around, and there'd be boats everywhere at a distance, but you could just barely see the top of them.
So once you got to Manila, what did they have you do?
Well, for the first day or two, it went kind of slow. We was getting ready for it to live for a while there. But pretty soon, though, they put us to work. And that was one of the jobs that I did. Being a musician, we didn't have our instruments with us. It's 50 miles behind us in a truck. But so we didn't have any instruments, and war was on at that time, and there were no instruments played. But so they kept us busy with other things, mail and payrolls, anything they can think to do. They kept us busy.
But because you were in the headquarters company, you weren't jumping out of any airplanes?
We were supposed to jump every 90 days to qualify for pay. See, we got extra dollars. The enlisted men got $50 extra a month, and officers $100. And later on, I made officer, a war officer, third grade, which is the bottom of the list. One day, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but one day after we'd got to Japan, the war was over and all that, our bandmaster came to me and said, "York, I want you to direct the band today, and I'm going to play the clarinet." Well, I didn't think anything about it. I just did it. Well, he did that 6 times. And I still never suspected anything, but he's watching me. That's what he's doing. And he said, and came to me one day and said, York, I've been watching your work, and I'm going home, and I can get you this job. So I was offered that, and I didn't want it at first because I want to go home, and pretty soon I would be. But anyhow, I had to volunteer 18 more months to get the appointment.
To be the leader of the band?
Director. The leader, yeah. See, there's another fellow above me, which was most of the time a lieutenant colonel or a colonel or a major, anyhow.
But when you got to the Philippines, the war's still going on.
Yeah.
You talked about some of the things they had you do. Was it hard for you to know that guys are fighting around you and that there wasn't a whole lot you could do in that regard?
No, it didn't bother me. I thought of it, yeah. And glad I wasn't in there. But I knew it had to be done. And I could have been in there, but I lucked out, type of thing. Said, no, I didn't. I didn't worry about it. But it was something to worry, I agree. But I didn't. It didn't bother me.
A lot of guys tell me about a welcome to the war moment, if you will, a time when they realize, you know what, this is real. I could die. My friends could die. This is not a game. Was there a moment like that for you overseas?
Well, I thought about it some, but it didn't dwell with me long because I'm not a worrier. I'm a thinker. No, I didn't worry about it. Because if it was going to happen, it's going to happen.
So when did you finally start getting to play some music over there?
Well, no, we didn't play our instruments much. Matter of fact, we didn't really play our instruments till we got in Japan.
And when did that happen?
Well, we landed in Japan. See, they flew us. That's one thing I liked about the parent troop was they flew us. They didn't boat us, but they flew us, and we landed September the 1st, got there about midnight in the Yokohama Air Base, and the peace treaty was signed the next day.
And that's why you were flying there, to be part of those festivities,
well,
right?
Believe it or not, we were.
So anybody that's ever, well, if they visited Honolulu lately and they've gone out to the Mighty Mo, the USS Missouri that rests there at Pearl Harbor, and they've certainly heard that story. They've probably seen the footage of General MacArthur and the U.S. officials aboard the Mighty Missouri signing those documents. And you were there. You were on the Missouri.
I was there. We were on the second deck. I want to call it the floor, but it's the second deck. We could look down and see the peace treaty being signed. And now, when the signing was over and leaving, that's when we played. We played the Stars, Stripes Forever and the Washington Post March.
And that was per the request of?
General Douglas MacArthur.
And had you been around him at all before, or was this the first time?
This first time. He loved military marches.
Did that make you nervous to perform at a moment like that?
No. But it made me feel good.
How big was your band that was playing?
We had, it varied, but in general, our band, now there was 12 of us on the boat. Now he wanted, my band instructor, Mr. Fred Rose, knew me, and I was first chair cornet. And so he told me pretty much everything. MacArthur requested 12 of the best musicians. Now, the rest of the band stayed in the base, at the base. They didn't go out on the boat at all. I got to tell you something about that, too.
All right.
The 1st Cavalry and the 11th Airborne Division were the first two outfits in Japan as occupational troops.
Right.
All right. Now, it was told that the other half of our band met them on the dock and played the old Gray Mary and what it used to be. Because that was
the old Gray Mary for the cavalry.
Cavalry,
So they were I guess you could say, trash-talking a little bit with their musical selection.
A little bit. I thought that was funny when I heard about it.
So that's what the rest of your band did that wasn't on the Missouri for the ceremony. Now, when you think about that, I mean, that is one of the most I don't know what the right word is, maybe one of the most memorable days in world history. It brought to an end probably the most transformational event in world history, World War II. Mm-hmm. And there were only 12 people who were playing in that band that day, and you're one of them. What does that make you think?
It makes me feel good that I was able to do it and wanted to do it and enjoyed doing it.
Did the significance of that moment, the magnitude of that event, strike you at the time?
Well, other than just feeling good and about it, other than that, not much more. I was proud that I was picked, but my concentration was on the music part. Didn't have much time to think about other things while you're playing. But, yeah, I felt good.
All right, guess what? I have embedded video of those surrender ceremonies in today's Hometown Hero story on our website, kmjnow.com. And while I do not have a recording of Mr. York and the band playing on the Missouri that day, here's a little taste of a newsreel from 1945.
The U.S. battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay was the setting for the signing of the surrender terms, which officially brought the war with Japan to an end. General Douglas MacArthur, supreme commander for the Allies, joined Admirals Nimitz and Halsey and other top commanders aboard the Missouri September 2nd, 1945.
The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial Forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you.
That is General Douglas MacArthur from September 2nd, 1945, with our guest today, Connell York, watching from above. We'll get the rest of Mr. York's story when Hometown Heroes continues next here on KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580. KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Before we finish up with Connell York, I want to quickly let you know about a show coming 2 weeks from today to the Clovis Veterans Memorial District Theater. It's Bob and Bing, The Road to Clovis. Bob Hope and Bing Crosby impersonators with a special program at 2 o'clock on New Year's Eve. Call 559-797-8155. Tickets are $25. Proceeds benefit the Central California Veterans Home Support Foundation. That number again, 559-797-8155. 8155. Back to Connell York, who played his cornet aboard the USS Missouri when the surrender documents were signed back in 1945. And I guess it's for occasions like that that you have a band to begin with.
What a band's for in the Army is to receive dignitaries. Every time even a colonel comes through, why, there'd be a band out there to meet him. God, we've stood out there all night long. The guy didn't show up. Yeah. Son of a gun. Now, MacArthur, he was requested 4 times, and we'd go play for him.
Did you ever have any interaction with him?
Just hello, and how are you, and thank you, Mr. York. See, a warrant officer called Mr.
Uh-huh.
He'd call him Mr. York. Yeah.
And I'm sure he had the signature corncob pipe, right?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He did.
What would you say was your perception, if you could summarize how you and your fellow bandmates felt about General MacArthur and what kind of figure he was to you? How would you put that in words?
I've got a good opinion of that man.
Uh-huh.
I think he was very, very, very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly was a good leader. If our leaders here in the States had listened to him more, I think things would have went better than what it did. But he was the last to receive any equipment. He requested airplane and everything else, and there was where the war was going on in Europe, and it came first. And finally, they got to, and then he started taking these islands back.
So did you feel that he got a bad rap for fleeing from Bataan and Corregidor?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people don't know that he left. He was there.
He was there, and he left, and he took some criticism for leaving his men behind.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think anything of it because, that's war.
Yeah.
And that leader, we need to protect that leader.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I looked at it.
You know, there are some people in this world that when they walk into a room, everybody notices. They have a commanding presence. Would you say he was one of those people?
Yes, he was. He was a big man. He'd about 6'2".
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, when he walked in a room, he got people's attention.
And you didn't want to play a bad note with him in the room.
Oh, God, no. No. It kicked you out, that's for sure.
Well, I know another aspect of your story that I think people will be interested in. I've talked to a lot of veterans who bring souvenirs home from the war. Sometimes they bring souvenirs home inside of them as in shrapnel that the enemy left in them. And your scars from war are a little different. It's not from bullets or artillery. It's from the after effects of a weapon that had never been used before August of 1945.
Yeah, and I've got the scars here to prove it.
Right on your arms.
On my arm, yeah.
And I'll if you're okay, I'll put some pictures of that up on our website so people can see for themselves.
Yeah.
But where did those come from? How did that happen?
Well, I was still a sergeant at this time.
Sergeant York.
I hadn't made warrant officer yet.
Mm-hmm.
See, that was after I got into Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they wanted a squad of men to go down to Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
They call it Hiroshima, but I call it Hiroshima.
Fair enough.
And release some prisoners. And they wanted people to volunteer. Well, I volunteered a lot.
Mm,
so
I
volunteered
that.
For that. And myself and six men went. They flew us down there. And we was there at sunup to free them. But they were gone. They had taken off already. They had heard about the war being over, I guess. And we never seen them. But
they
anyhow,
were in a prisoner of war camp or something?
It was.
Uh-huh.
But we waited. We waited around in that fallout that we didn't even know was there. Well, there were seven of us, and every one of those men died of cancer at 40 years old, but me. Mm. I'm the only one I'm still alive.
So this is only a month after this atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima that you're there. And you're walking around, and you have no idea that there's a danger.
We didn't know. We just didn't know. And we went to a clinic, and heck, they didn't know anything either. They were blisters.
And you just did it happen right away, or you woke up one morning and you had blisters?
No,
or what?
We had blisters that day or that next morning.
How long did you stay there in Hiroshima?
Not long, maybe. Couple hours.
You're only there a couple hours.
Yeah.
But just that exposure alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get back to that, but you're there in the aftermath of the greatest devastation really the world had ever seen from a military perspective.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see there?
It wasn't much to see.
It must have been hard.
It was leveled. Everything was leveled except the Buddha. Concrete Buddhas. Now they took the blast, but everything else was burned. And once in a while, you'd see a concrete building that didn't burn. It burned, but it was still the concrete standing there. But all the houses, everything else was leveled.
You're a 19-year-old kid. No one had ever seen this before. You certainly hadn't.
No.
Did you feel like it was the end of the world? I mean, what did it do to you emotionally to see that kind of destruction?
I felt sorry for them.
Mm-hmm.
I really did. They were hungry. I know one time when we were on the train heading for Sendai, there was, I don't know, 8 or 10 kids, most of them boys, and one little girl was coming up to our window. And because they found out that we would throw candy bars to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this little girl now, she was standing back over there, maybe 10 feet, 15, and I threw her a candy bar. Well, these other guys ran back there to get it. Well, the train was just going real, real, real slow. And I jumped out, got that candy bar, and gave it to that little girl.
Mm.
Got back on the train. That's how I felt. I felt sorry for him.
Well, that little Japanese girl is probably still around somewhere.
I hope so. Yeah. And she'll never forget it.
And I guess you won't either.
No. No.
Getting back to the burns. So you're only on the ground in Hiroshima for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
But then you fly back up to Sendai?
Yeah, we flew back.
And the next morning you wake up, you look at your arms?
That morning.
The same day?
The same day.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, these little blisters, they come pretty soon.
So what did you think was going on?
Well, we didn't know. We finally figured it out, because they wouldn't tell us anything at the clinic. They acted as if they didn't know what it was.
So all seven of you had them?
Yeah, including a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was still a sergeant at the time.
Now, you said you didn't get scared too often. You weren't a worrier, but I can't imagine having your arms on fire and
well,
not being worried.
I can't remember. I had to feel bad about it, I know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know enough about it to even be scared, I guess. I don't mm-hmm. know.
So, as you said, the other six guys who were with you that day, they all died in their 40s.
In their 40s, yeah.
So, when that happened, what did that do to you?
Well, I just said, you lucky you. You just escaped it some way.
You didn't think you were next?
No, because this was in, oh, well, we had a round robin letter is how we kept track.
Mm-hmm.
We'd get a letter and the widow would write and tell us.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we found out. Well, I didn't know. I just didn't know. But the blisters were gone, all right. The scars were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have them. And I didn't think too much about it, except that I'm going to get on with my life and not worry about it, but I don't like it, but no use of worrying about it.
When you look in the mirror or you look down at your arms and you see those scars now, what does it mean to you?
Well,
what does it remind you of?
It kind of aggravates me in a way because I can't wear short sleeve shirts. I got to wear a long sleeve to cover mm-hmm. it up. And that's really the biggest thought I have is, oh, heck, I hate to wear this. Because they're so ugly, I don't want to go bareheaded, bare-armed.
Does it ever make you think, you know, it could have been a whole lot worse for me? And it was a whole lot worse for a lot of other people?
Occasionally. I don't stay on the subject long. Mm-hmm. But occasionally I do, yeah, even now.
Because a lot of guys didn't get to come home and see that wife of theirs again. What was that reunion like for you when you finally got back to the States?
Oh, I tell you, that was a good reunion. I tell you, things went well.
Because you hadn't been married long when you went over.
No, not
what,
long.
Weeks, months?
Weeks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you'd spent more time overseas than you'd spent married. A lot more time.
At that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I spent three and a half years in the Army is what I did.
So tell me about that. I think we have plenty of listeners who like that romantic side of things. They want to picture you getting back and seeing her again for the first time. What? Tell us about that in terms of how you remember it.
Well, she lived in Kerman, and I rode the bus from Camp Beale,
mm-hmm.
California, down to Trinity. She lived on Trinity Street. They knew I was coming home, but they didn't know what time.
Mm-hmm.
So here I came. I walked down from, it was half a mile down there. And, I tell you, to me, it was a joyful time, very joyful. I've talked to her later, and she said she was very happy too, so.
I imagine so.
So it was good. It was joyous, yeah.
And you had all those happy years together? Any kids, grandkids?
Yes. Yeah, I got three grandchildren and two greats. And there's six school teachers in my family.
Mm-hmm. And there's one pretty good piano tuner in your family.
I used to be, yeah. Yeah.
How'd you get started with that?
My grandfather was a tuner.
Uh-huh.
And I had to work in his shop when I was a kid. And I learned it from him. the time I was 12, heck, I could tune them in the shop there. Mm-hmm. I never tuned any commercially, but in his shop. And then I'd go with him and on Saturdays. I worked everywhere I could if there was a piano shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran in North Carolina, I ran into some people that had a piano shop. And I worked for them all my odd hours. Enjoyed every bit of it.
How many pianos do you think you've tuned in your life?
Ooh, I could almost tell you because I've got a record of all of them.
Do you really?
Yep. Since 1952, I've kept a record every piano I've tuned. Now, 1 year, I tuned 800.
800 in 1 year.
Woo. That's it. That includes repair. See, I did major repair work.
Now, I know we're running short on time here, but do you have a favorite piano tuning story that you like to remember?
There was a fella in Easton called me and wanted me to see if his piano was any good. But he had it in a water tower, outside in the water tower.
Right.
And it had been in there for years. That thing was just rusted. It was goner.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, well, no, this piano can't be repaired. And it made him so mad because I couldn't repair that old rusty piano. And gosh, it just, you know, rust took over.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it in there in that old wet. See, there's three enemies to a piano, moisture, mice, and moths, in that order.
Mm-hmm.
And that was moisture. Anyhow, I couldn't do anything about it. It made him mad. Over there in Japan, see, we were allowed to bring home souvenirs.
Right.
For a while. They put a stop to it later. Our commanding officer played the piano, and he knew I was a tuner. And he spotted a piano that he wanted. And he said, York, can you box that piano up for me and saw it and send it home? I said, sure I can.
Mm-hmm.
So I took three men, myself. We went down, built a box for it, put the piano in it, made it ready for shipment, and turned it over to him, said it's all ready to be shipped. So he sent out some trucks, and I helped load it and all that. He sent it home.
Hmm. Spoils of war.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You were allowed to do that.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Did you bring anything home with you other than
those
scars? I brought
a couple of rifles.
Uh-huh.
And I brought some bayonets and one sword.
Mm-hmm. So initially, you thought you'd be going over there and jumping out of airplanes. You ended up mostly playing music over there.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, are you thankful for that?
Sure I am. Yeah, I'd rather play music than jump out of airplanes anyhow.
When you think back on it now, when you think about the life that you've led, all the people whose pianos you've tuned who are pretty thankful to have you around, for your children, your grandchildren. What are you most thankful for? What gives you the most satisfaction?
My wife that stayed with me all those hours I worked. I got to give her number one. Number two is that I enjoyed my work very much, and therefore I do a much better job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of that. I'm still getting calls, and I hadn't tuned in a couple of years.
Does it give you pride to be a World War II veteran?
Very much so. I feel that I did my part.
Mm-hmm.
And music is part of it.
Sure.
And I'm glad that I could and did. I'd do it again.
When you think about your grandchildren and that generation and all the people who weren't alive for that time in our nation's history, what do you think is the most important thing for us to remember about World War II and what America was able to do then?
Just remember that there was a lot of lives given. Always salute our flag and have respect for our national anthem and be loyal to their country because we got a good one and we want to keep it that way if we can.
Amen. Thanks again. That's Connell York, 85 years old. He's been our guest today. If you want to see what he looks like and see what those radiation burn scars on his arms look like, it's better yet, see what he looked like when he was 18 years old and in the 11th Airborne. You can check out those pictures at kmjnow.com or on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. That's our program for today. Join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9 KMJ.
The U.S. battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay was the setting for the signing of the surrender terms which officially brought the war with Japan to an end. General Douglas MacArthur, supreme commander for the Allies, joined Admirals Nimitz and Halsey and other top commanders aboard the Missouri September 2, 1945. The ceremony took place on a Sunday. Foreign Minister Shigemitsu and other representatives of the Japanese nation on the deck of the battleship, even as the world recalled that other Sunday in 41 and the act of treachery which shattered the calm of the Pacific Ocean and the world. Now at last, defeated Japan and the Allies were to sign the surrender terms.
The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. As Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, I announce it my firm purpose, in the tradition of the countries I represent, to proceed in the discharge of my responsibilities with justice and tolerance, while taking all necessary dispositions to ensure that the terms of surrender are fully, promptly, and faithfully complied with.
First to sign the surrender document was Foreign Minister Mamoru Shigemitsu for Japan's emperor. Articles in the surrender terms included the following. All provisions of the Potsdam Declaration were accepted. All armed forces were surrendered unconditionally. Acknowledgement that authority of the emperor and the Japanese government was subject to the will of the Allied Supreme Commander, General Douglas MacArthur, now signing. The first pen became a cherished memento for General Wainwright. The second pen went to Britain's General Percival. In order, the nation signed. General Su Yung Chang for China. For the United Kingdom, Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser. General MacArthur called on the representative of the Soviet Union, Lieutenant General Kazuma N. Derevyanko. Also, the representative of Canada, Colonel L. Moore Cosgrove. In all, there were 12 signatures affixed to the surrender document, and then in 20 minutes it was over. Nearly 4 years of bitter conflict had come to this brief ceremony. The war chapter was closed, and a weary world looked hopefully to new horizons of enduring peace.